Welcome to the Intuitive Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Riddick. I'm an author, teacher, and eternal seeker of truth. I am on a mission to spread metaphysical knowledge to help you awaken your spirit. If you want to learn how to open the door to your divine self, you are in the right place. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. We have a lovely guest today. Justin Shaw is joining us. Justin is the author of Sorcery 101, 13 Rungs to a Higher Elevation of Consciousness, which is a transformative guide that uses source energy to heal trauma and manifest a new life. Justin draws from his past as a former stand-up comedian and his personal journey through overcoming trauma, mental and emotional health challenges, and addiction. And he's joining us today to discuss his book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
I'm so interested in hearing about what was the impetus for writing this book. Take us kind of like through your story, really.
Yeah, well, it's quite a journey. So I've just always, you know, struggled in my life. Like, there's a lot of it of after being through a lot of therapy and a lot of work on myself. You know, there was just a lot of neglect in my childhood. More than there really wasn't much abuse, I would say. It's more of this slow burn. I kind of go over my book. There's two types of trauma. There's the big T trauma, which are kind of, you know, knee jerking, you know, events of, you know, of physical abuse, violence, you know, sexual harassment or molestation, you know, things like that. Just real knee jerking events that, and there's this lowercase T trauma, which is kind of what I've been through. It's a slow burn of just kind of emotional neglect. I just grew up in a household that was, it was just an emotion vacuum. I was like, it was like Fight Club. You know, the first rule was you don't talk about your feelings. And the second rule was you don't talk about your feelings. So anything emotional at all was not discussed. I mean, anything even remotely emotional, like even in ways of guidance, there was just nothing there. So I struggled a lot, especially, I mean, in my 20s, there was a just ridiculous things happening to me. There was jail experiences and, you know, getting kicked out of sober livings to sleep on benches for a week or so. And I mean, there's just nasty things that happened because of this. You know, if you don't tell a child that they're loved, cared about, and valued and important, then they're going to look for the world, you know, to the world for, you know, value and importance and love. And the world is always going to tell them they suck and they're not loved and they're not cared for and they're not safe. So that's what happened with me. So there was just a lot of that going on. And then I was able to pull it all together and finally kind of had some rehab experiences that were like starting to click. And I kind of got it together. I was doing the AA thing for quite a while and recovery. And I saw this really cool program that, you know, helped people. But there was also an aspect to it that just there was something missing. And that focus for me for what I was noticed for AA was that the focus is on sobriety. And it delivers what it promises, and I was sober, but I was missing so much, and I was getting bored with it. And the aspect that's missing is this thriving. There's this kind of, you know, like, let's heal enough to not use drugs and not drink, and which is a big win. I'm not, you know, I'm never against AA and stuff like that at all. I just feel like there's a component missing, and it's this thriving component. So I went through some horrible things in the last like few years. It's really in the last like 2 years I've really been, you know, getting better and kind of had my cocooning period, I like to call it. That really has been transformative. But I had a lot of deaths. I, you know, my mother, my sister, I had a childhood friend. I, you know, my ex-fiance, who's incredibly emotionally damaged, just took off with my son, and I haven't seen him for 2 years. And I just had all these events happen that just were horrible. Horrible things, and it brought me to my knees, and it was just this moment of like, what do I do? Like, I need something to take my focus off this, and I want to help other people in these positions, and that I must have a meaning. And I was living in Sedona at the time, and it's kind of the mecca for, spiritual things and all things spiritual. So it was good timing, and I was living there for a year, and this whole thing, just the system came to me. It was this kind of 13 rungs, and I had all this information in my head that was like, okay, this is how things work, this is how people can thrive, but I had to organize it. So, and I'd kind of thought of the 12 steps, but like moving forward is good, but moving up is better. So, like a bird has a better perspective and view on things than a worm. So I did the 13 rungs, which was able to organize these thoughts I had in my head. And I've had some extremely transformative experiences that just really changed my view on what this world is and how everything works. And so that's how it all kind of sorcery came about. And I spell with a U. It's not, you can leave your cauldrons and magic wands in the closet. No, we'd all like to turn our roommate into a frog, but it's not that kind of sorcery. It's spelled with a U, so it's kind of distanced itself from the magic of actual sorcery and things like that. So it's Soucery, and it's just using source energy, which is the energy field that is around us at all times. Which I had an incredible experience with the realization that we are fish swimming in an ocean of consciousness. Like if you ask a fish about the water it swims in, it would say, "What water? What are you talking about?" And so it made me realize that we are swimming, to lack of a better term, in this sea of consciousness, in the sea of information that can be tapped into at any time, that can truly be a well of healing. And after tapping into it and doing this, I had to get this out and write this book and get this out there. And it's just come out recently, so it's going to be fun to see where this goes, certainly.
Definitely. So I'm really curious about, I wanted to kind of go back to your experiences in Sedona because number one, it is kind of known as this, like you said, like a healing mecca, right? With all their vortices. And there are so many places to go visit up there for, I would say, alternative medicine or alternative therapies. But in your, from you personally, what were some of your transformative experiences specifically in Sedona as you're working through sobriety?
Yeah, it was so much fun. Like, so right after this whole issue, the last thing that happened, this and a whole series of events happened over the course of 4 years. And the last thing, the final thing, was my kind of fiance just cutting me out of, taking our infant son and just leaving. So after that was the moment that just brought me to my knees. And it was just kind of a trauma response of just like, screw it, I've got nothing here. I'm just going to move up to Sedona. I'm from Phoenix. That's where I am currently. I moved back down here. I found out when I was up there, the natives wouldn't, even though it's a beautiful place, wouldn't go there to live. They would go there for a time being and kind of get their healing in and then come back to wherever they were. And it's funny, that's how it worked out for me without even realizing that's what was happening. So I just moved up there and I started living. I got a job in this little place that helps traumatize young adults basically kind of get back, not get back their life, get into life. So they're well off. Most of their parents have plenty of money, but we're terrible parents. So their kids are not adjusting to society. So they're 18 to 29. So I was working with them, which was also helping my spiritual growth. But and then so I'd Moving to Sedona, the first thing I did was go on Bell Rock, which is one of the more famous kind of vortices there. And I did a meditation that, for about an hour, and just put my intentions out. There's like, whatever I'm here for, work through me, tell me what I'm here for. I want to, get out there and help people and just guide me. And so I had this kind of experience there. And then about 6 months in, I was just on a hike, and that's when it really, the kind of download came to me that was like, you're going to write a book. This is how you're going to structure it. This is what you're going to call it. You're going to make kind of bring to light as many sorcerers as you can, as it were. So it really was an incredible experience. And I was in a lot of pain the whole time. Like I was really I'd had do well and have these experiences, and then I'd be down. It was just this roller coaster. But I came out better for it. And Sedona is now, like, it was always a special, cool place, but now it's a really special place for me. So yeah, I love it up there.
So what was your concept then? As you're working through your sobriety, what is your concept of God then, and what is it now after all these experiences that you've had?
It's changed dramatically, I can tell you. So when I first got sober, this is a very good question, by the way. I like this question. So when I first got sober, I did the whole Christian thing. So I had this experience in the rehab center where it was kind of like, I'm done. I don't know what to do with myself. And they just, I had this prayer circle get around with me. And like, I just was at an end. They all kind of prayed and like, okay, we're praying to Jesus that you come into your heart and so on and so forth. And they did this prayer. And like, there's something happened where this electric kind of shock came through me and like just changed me from that moment. And you know, now I realize now that this is something I created with just the belief in myself and in just belief in general. And I could have been hoping for Batman to come and save me. You know, like it could have been anything, something just like both outside and inside of myself. And so after this happened, it's like, oh, okay, this is real. Like I just have to get to church and be doing that. And so I was going to church quite a bit during this period of sobriety. It was about 6 years, and trying to understand better. And in the book, I make it pretty humorous. My interactions with pastors and things, and just like I'm a former comedian, so like some of the things they would say would just make me laugh. Like some of the things they believed, and like the things in the Bible, and like I was just so interested in it, but also just like this. None of this is like. Some of it sounds right. Some of it does, but this other stuff doesn't sound right at all. So it was just that time period, and the final straw for me with Christianity. First of all, I don't believe Jesus is a Christian. I don't think he would come back down and say, "This is, oh, this is it. You guys figured it out." But Jesus kind of came, I believe, to drive people away from religion, not create a new one. And so, you know, I don't think he wants followers as much as he wants peers. So Jesus is not the problem. It's what Christianity has turned into. And I can tell you this because as I sat with my mother, as she's dying, I was filled with fear and dread, filled with fear and dread. And I still have to let go of the institution of Christianity for making me, programming me to feel that way. I mean, no one can make me feel that way, but they programmed me to feel that. Because my mother was not a practicing Christian, never went to church, just, you know, did her thing, stayed in her, she was a very comfort zone type person, but made me think that because of this, that, you know, she was going to be hell and damnation for the, just these thoughts. And I didn't get to enjoy anything about her final days because it hurt so bad. And I had such fear and everything inside of me that where I'm standing now, I would have been such a good shepherd into the afterlife. Like, you know, this is going to be so much fun. This is, you know, your pain is over. She had bad cancer, and she kept in a lot of negative energy towards everything that happened to her. She wouldn't ever let anything go, and this kind of turns into cancer, which it did for her. So that was kind of the final straw. And what it is now is has completely changed. I've let go of all these past beliefs, which is a big part of sorcery. Like there's 13 rungs for a very specific reason. The number 13 is was actually it was a Christian type thing that the number 13 is unlucky, and we've adopted this as a fact. And I've looked at it, and apparently it's just because there were 13 disciples, and like Judas was the 13th one at the Last Supper, so it makes no sense. But we've adopted this as a fact that number 13, to the point where there's no 13 floors. There's no number 13 floor in hotels. Like, this is ridiculous. The fact is, the number 13 is very lucky, and it is a number associated with the divine, and it brings luck to those who embrace it. So there's 13 rungs because one of the key elements of sorcery is to start deconstructing these beliefs that we think are true, but maybe they're not. So that's what happened with me, is starting to deconstruct these beliefs. and start to let in. It's AA, and AA is disguised Christianity. If it's just a fact, it's what it is. And so AA and Christianity is about letting God in, whereas now I feel, and what I've based source around, is letting God out. And we are this reflection of the divine. It is where we are that. And that, you know, makes me feel powerful. And I hope it makes other people more powerful too, because this whole thing of keeping people down is religion is, all religions are fine. They're all pointed in the right direction. But when you get caught up too much in the dogma and the rules and all that, that's when it starts to get bad. So it's, you know, there's this both and that I talk about in the book, that the world is a world of gray. There is no black and white. You know, religion can bring so many amazing things and be so fabulous to so many people, but it can also be incredibly destructive. And so it's this double-edged thing. So the world is rarely black and white. So that's how I view it now. And now it's just more of a embracing of everything.
So then, okay, in terms of source energy or source, what is it for you today?
Source is a field that surrounds us at all times. It is, the best way to explain it is in Star Wars. I put that, there's a lot of pop culture in the book, because I grew up, when I said emotion neglectful, that the TV was kind of my parents growing up. So all these movies, the 80s, 90s, like 2000, they're all like programmed into me so well, because I would just watch them over and over, because that was the one thing that brought me joy in this kind of loveless, emotionless life I had. So all these movies are just programmed into me. So this part of me that wrote this book, like all this kind of pop culture stuff came out with it. And, you know, I think a lot of the, you know, I think some of the riddles to life's mysteries can be found in the nooks and crannies of pop culture. So there's a lot of references I give in the book to pop culture and things like that. And the biggest one is Star Wars and the Force. I mean, you know, Obi-Wan kind of explains it perfectly when he says it is a field of energy made up of all living creatures that surrounds us and binds the universe together. And that is exactly what it is. And you can tune into it, and things can really change. You can manifest anything. It's a manifestation. So it's like the old, those old, both of us are old enough to remember the radios from like the 90s that you kind of turn the little dial, and then they have that silver thing. So you kind of turn the dial and you get to the station, but it's really scratchy and you have to kind of adjust. So that's mind heart coherence. That is tuning into the manifestation. And once you're tuned into it, it's like turning off airplane mode. So the first time it happened to me, it was like, I've been in airplane mode my whole life, and it just turns off and all these realities and truths and direction comes to me. And it's all about just tuning in and getting that clear signal. And once you create that, most of society is, their minds and hearts are completely jumbled. And this is why society is the way it is. If we had a society of people that knew how to tune their minds and hearts in and get this direct signal, we wouldn't have any problems. It really would be a utopia, but alas, it's certainly not even close to the way it is. But that's what it is. It is, yeah, it's like a station you turn into, a manifestation.
How do you personally, you know, tune into this station? You know, I've met a lot of people who struggle with finding like a way to do this that works for them, but also trusting the information that comes. You know, when you're tuning in, there's a lot of distrust of, I'll just call it like the inner voice, because, you know, I think we're as creatures, we're naturally skeptical. And so when we hear a message from within, from whatever that voice, whatever you want to call it, naturally, we don't trust it. We question it to death, to the point where there is no point anymore asking, because you're not going to trust it, right? So what is your practice to like tune in, but how did you build that trust? Because I think that's also the sticking point for a lot of people.
Great question. Also covered in the book. So there's a technique that I wouldn't say I developed it, but like I kind of added to it a little bit. But I one of kind of the spiritual instructors that was important to me, Greg Braden, had talked about, like the mind heart coherence. It is a secret and it's not a secret. It's as ancient as it gets, and also no one knows about it. It's very strange, but kind of tuning into it. I mean, obviously in meditation, but you can also train your intuition, which I go over on how to do that. So instinct and intuition are very different things. People use them interchangeably, but they're not the same at all. Instinct lives in the gut and intuition lives in the heart. And when we go through trauma and things, and instinct is still very good, we need it. But when we go through trauma and things, the instinct gets turned up and the intuition gets turned down. And a lot of times, we can just leave these lives full of fear. So if instinct is very good, when you're walking on the street home from work and you see a car coming towards you and it's got a gun hanging out, this is a good time to give in to instinct and get the hell out of the way and duck into some bushes. Now, after an event like that happens, if it's not processed properly, then every car coming down the street, you're gonna think there's a gun hanging out, and you're gonna jump into a bush and it's gonna wreck your life, and then you're gonna get home and never want to leave again. So this is too high. Your instinct is too high. So it's to know the difference between the two, and how to develop it is in meditation. And also outside of meditation, you can take five deep breaths, really deep breaths in and out, because you have to clear your mind first. It's very important to clear your mind, because you're going to ask through the heart. So the mind has to be clear. So I do 5, 5, 5, and 5. So 5, 5, 5, 5 deep breaths, 5 seconds in, hold for 5 seconds, 5 seconds out, and do that 5 times. That seems to clear my brain every time. And after it's clear, then you want to develop a conversation with your intuition. So you ask yes or no questions and you get a feeling for what yes or no means. You put your hand in your heart because that's where you want the answer coming from. And then you ask a yes question that you know the answer is yes to. So you get an answer. Okay, it's like, okay, that's my yes. Some people's yeses are different. To me, it's an inner voice that says yes. For some people, it could be a color, it could be a shape, it could be the word yes, it could be a voice. It's different for everyone, I can't say. And then you ask a question you know the answer no to. Okay, so now you've developed what yes and no sound and feel. And it could be a feeling. It may not be anything. It just could be, you could get chills or something. That's a yes. And then no chills is a no. I mean, it could be anything. So you have to develop and know what that feels like. And then after you develop it for a while, then you can start asking questions like basic things, like what should I, should I call this person? Should I go this event? Should I do this? They ask it very simple questions that yes or no answers to, and you develop this over 30 days, and then you can start kind of asking about future events and play with it a little bit. I did one like just a couple months ago. I got my computer was shutting down and stuff, and so I kind of played with it a little bit, and so I took the computer to the data doctors over there, and he was like, all right, give us a 1 to 3 days. And I asked my intuition, like, okay, is it going to be, what did I say? I said, is it going to be fixed today? And I put my hand on my heart, I got a clear no. But later on that afternoon, it said they called and it was ready. It's like, oh man, I got such a clear no. Like, what was going on? And I got it back home, and an hour later, it starts shutting down again. I just realized I didn't ask, is it going to be ready? I asked if it was going to be fixed. So it is like a warden of specificity that you have to be specific with this thing, because when you're talking to the force that created the universe, something as detailed oriented as the universe, specificity is going to be key. So developing this voice over time will get you more comfortable with where to go, because you'll know it. And now I know it. Like, now I know. And I had a crazy one. Oh my gosh, I had a crazy one happen the other day. I guess it was about 2 weeks ago. I was eating steak. And this is a life-saving one. So our intuition isn't gonna save us from bad things, but it'll steer us away. Like if your house is going to be on fire, it'll at least tell you to get out. It's not gonna save your stuff, but it'll tell you to get out. And mine was, I was eating steak, and I'd swallowed down, and the instinctual thing, it kind of got lodged, and the instinctual thing is to kind of just swallow it again, get it down. And I live in an apartment with just me and my dog. So If this would have happened, I would not be sitting here right now. Right before I was about to kind of like swallow it down, the inner voice screamed at me, not audibly, but in the inner voice, it said, "Stop." And I stopped in my tracks. I was like, "Oh my God, all right." It's like, if you swallow, you die. So I'm sitting there like, okay, what do I do? And then it walked me through the steps because like it wasn't completely lodged. So it said, inhale the air around the meat and like inhale it up and then just shoot it out. And I did that. And I am sitting here talking to you because of the relationship I developed with my intuition.
And there was no point early on where you ever doubted any like initial messages.
Oh yeah, early on, yeah. No, early on you doubt. It's totally normal. You doubt, you're not sure, but you're building trust. And there are things that may not be, completely accurate all the time, and that is mostly due to our emotions and when we're asking it. There was like, you want to ask it in good times when your mind's not, because I've developed this point where like I don't necessarily have to get the breaths away to hear it pretty clearly. But there are some times when it, our emotions can kind of get in the way and then we receive a different answer. But so it's always important in the beginning to like clear it out and then ask questions. Again, you're starting with questions that don't really matter. Should I take my dog for a walk right now? Like things like that. You're just developing that yes, no relationships. You just know what it is. And then once you receive information from it, just trust it. Because and once you develop that relationship with your higher self, it's going to be wrong very little, very little. And it seems to be very little when it comes to you. It might not be accurate at predicting other people's things or future events. You're not going to become Nostradamus or something. But when it comes to you. And especially the physical and emotional safety of you or someone close to you love, it's never going to be wrong. With little things like that, like the computer or something, maybe it's wrong once in a while and that's normal, but with the important things, it'll never be wrong. And it's important to know that you just have to trust it when it comes to really important things.
Definitely. So obviously, you trusted it when you wrote this book. So, how did that download come? And did it come out of the blue? I mean, do you consider yourself a writer? What was it something like completely left field where it made you stop and think, what am I hearing? Like, why would I do this?
Yeah, it was. I had quite an experience with in meditation the previous years forward that made me know that there's more to this than I could even understand or realize. And when I got the download for the book, it was like, well, no, I'd never done any writing or anything. I went to college and did kind of writing in there, but none of it was any good. So to have this. To have this happen and to come out the way it did is unexplainable. It is truly unexplainable that I did that because I don't like to toot my own horn here, but it's really good. Like it's funny and it's a constant cycle of just making you laugh, think, and feel throughout the entire book because I knew I had to write it for the shattered concentration of Generation TikTok, so I knew I had to keep them focused and keep me focused. I have crazy things too. I'm much more focused now, but I mean, the way it came out, it's just bizarre that, it created something so amazing from me who had very little experience writing, and I've always been funny, and that aspect got worked in certainly, but it's beyond anything I could do on my own. Something else came out of me to create this and make this whole thing, and it's so fun to see where it's gonna take me. It's a lot of it's really cool. I keep getting fired from jobs. I just like I need to find a job that I can't get. I want to work for myself and a job I can't get fired from because like I can't. I just constantly get fired, and that's part of my trauma and my frazzled brain. And this trauma is so like it clouds our minds and just sits in the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe is so important. It's, part of our decision making and makes up our personality and regulates emotions. And all that stuff is coming from the frontal lobe. And that's where trauma sits. So everyone knows someone whose life is a dumpster fire. And I was that guy, certainly. So It's just it's crazy to think how this is all turned out. It's really fun.
Was writing the book, did you learn more things about yourself or your own healing journey? Or did you, when you were creating this, did you feel guided during the process too? And it was part of like you just continuously healing.
I say at the very end of the book, it was a pleasure writing this book for me. And if you got something out of it too, great. Because that's the truth. It was all for me. But I also knew in writing it that this could help a lot of people in the meantime as well. And so I just kind of let it out and let it in and let it out. And I just continued to do my practices and having be completely substance free and doing things that are in the book that are focused on health and maintaining good body, mind, spirit. Like that is the trifecta that the medical community just doesn't understand. I mean, it's really only recently that they've kind of said, oh, the mind and body are connected. Oh, okay. Wow, that's we've kind of known that for thousands of years. And we're in the Western society are just making that connection. But the spirit is still completely left out. We're never going to be able to heal people. And they don't really want to heal people, right? Like it's because a healed person doesn't line anyone's pockets. A healed person doesn't keep coming in for doctor's visits. They want to just it's all about the symptoms. Whatever your symptom is, it could be, substance abuse or anxiety or depression or, even physical ailments like, autoimmune diseases. And these are all things caused by unbalanced energy and stress and these things. And they can only be just maintained with medicine where it's at. They'll never heal it because they're leave out the spirit portion of it. So that's what I bring into it, and I hope to actually help to heal people so that they don't lean on. I mean, the medical community failed me. I'm very grateful to be out of that and made a lot of my issues worse. So I'm not, and I there's again, it's both and the great world of gray. If you have an acute injury, go see a doctor. They set the bone, but it's the body that heals that bone. The doctor doesn't do any of the healing. He sets the bone, and the body heals itself. Whereas a chronic condition, they don't really know what to do with chronic conditions because it's something that never really goes away. Well, because the bone in this scenario hasn't been set, so it never really heals right. So this is kind of setting the bone, I guess, so that you can allow the body to heal itself, but you have to know how to do it. And healing trauma is the most important and most misunderstood thing in the world. So I think this is a very valuable thing for people to understand.
Definitely. And what are your thoughts on when you talk about like mind, body, spirit, like health, what are your thoughts on like materialism and technology having an impact on that, on like holistic health, I guess?
Yeah, it's had a huge impact. I've when I kind of had my experience happen, I kind of realized that the things I was worrying about, like I am the sky, and everything I was thinking about is like weather, like clouds passing by, and it's like none of this matters. So one of the things I did, and although I may get back on it, I might be a positive voice for some, because again, social media gray area can be
Yeah.
both helpful and destructive. But the phones and things like that, it's I deleted that, and I've been off of it 4 years. And that's part of what helped me write this book was when they put blinders on a horse, it runs a better race. And so me off of social media helped me run a better race. And again, it's not that it's all bad. You can get some very uplifting things off. It's all how you were using it. And I was not using it properly. So I just got off of it. And I now am well aware of how much time I'm spending. But it's not even just social media. I mean, the news just wants to hit you with fear and loathing. Like that's what sells. So they're just going to cover anything that brings fear out of you, because that's what we want. Like it's subconsciously, that's what we want. We're scrolling through the news because we want to feel fear. It's a subconscious thing. It's weird and messed up, but that's how it is. That's how we're wired. So So even things like that, I try to keep my news intake. I like to know what's going on, but I keep that to kind of a minimum of 10 minutes or so. But it can be very destructive, and because you'd see all these illusionary things. Oh, I have this great story that so I so when I got on I got on Facebook back when you needed a college, that's showing my age, back when you needed a college email to get on Facebook. That's when I joined Facebook. It was a long time ago. But a few years after that passed, like everyone started getting on it and everything. And I had a friend from high school that was on it, and he obviously done very well for himself. He had a good job that he would post about, and he had this very attractive wife, and he had these two kids, and I saw him over the years, like 3 or 4 years, and kind of through 2009 to 2013, you kind of see him grow up, and they all these pictures and everything looked good and happy and amazing. And in 2013, I guess it was, he posted these pictures that he was on this amazing vacation in Greece. There was no kids there. It was this amazing vacation in Greece, and just all these pictures, and they're eating and they're enjoying the beach, and like all these, just I mean, it just looked like just what a vacation. Like, this guy's living the life. And 1 month later, he announced that he was getting divorced and he asked for privacy. So that's the illusion these things create. Is that trip was probably terrible, but they had to keep up this illusion that they were having a great time. That, like in the maybe 15 minutes where they weren't fighting, that's when they take a picture and like post on social media. And but that trip was probably insanely horrible for both of them, because 1 month later they were getting a divorce. That was their like final, like, let's see if we can pull this together. The kids weren't there, and like pull this together with the family, and they couldn't do it. And so that's the illusion it creates. And someone like me that was sitting there, single and without, oh man, that must be the life. Wow, he's just really living it up. I am so jealous. And that wasn't it at all. It was just a total bogus illusion. So we have to be aware that there's illusions everywhere, and none of it is what it see. I use another example of the pyramids. And when I was growing up, like, I only saw pictures of the pyramids like online or in textbooks, or and they always show this majestic open Egyptian desert and like all this amazing things. And then I had a friend go there a few years ago, and then he took a picture from facing the other way, and like the pyramids are like 900 yards from like a goddamn KFC. It's a complete illusion. They're right next to Cairo, and like the streets are like just a few hundred yards away. And it makes this impression that, it's a 2 day journey by camel to get there, like, and it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. There's the you can the street vendors just a football field away. It's just there's just illusions everywhere, and you don't know what is and what isn't. So that's the danger of especially social media in particular, and articles, and people are going to report and spin things. That's the other thing about the news. They're going to report in whatever direction they want to report it. The MSNBC is going to have one take, and Fox News is going to have another, and then the truth is usually in the middle. But they're completely no one's reporting the truth in the middle. They're these two skewed aspects of the same event happening, and that's our news. That's what we I think it's all fake news. I don't think any of it is actually real. So it's you have to take things with truly a grain of salt, because you don't know what is and what isn't. And that's scary. It's just the way it is.
It definitely is scary, and it does impact your mental health. And I think there's a lot of awareness about it, but still, I think for the younger generation, there is an addictive aspect of it, which is extremely unhealthy and worrisome. And a lot of it, as you were implying, is performative. It's insincere. It's not really a reflection of reality. So I was just curious about your thoughts, because I think you do talk about it in your book, like materialism and just how even being on social media to a certain extent can impact your mental well-being.
Yeah, no, it's huge. I mean, wanting things is fine, but there's always this feeling of separation, which isn't real. Like, if we're constantly feeling separate from things, then we're just constantly going to feel separate from everything. It's the materialism aspect, it's, again, it's illusionary in that a lot of people who have a lot of things, those things don't, once you get to a point and you can get everything you ever wanted, those people knew how to use the secret and how to like get what they want and creating that. But if you're not all the way healed and getting that, it feels hollow and empty. But if you're able to heal yourself along the way and then get everything you want, then those, you can enjoy those things more. But a lot of people who have a lot of things can't really enjoy them, and they're just trying to get the next thing, and it is absolutely drug-like. It's an addiction. The suffering doesn't come from anything itself, drugs, alcohol, shopping, these things. It's not that, it's the attachment to them that brings all the suffering. So once you're attached to that and you're constantly chasing the high, and shopping is one of them, certainly, the materialism aspect and having this and not having that, and that's an addiction. And it's one of many addictions that kind of go, like there's and that's why this book is for every, people say, I suffer from, depression, I suffer from substance abuse, I suffer from gambling addiction. How about we just end it as I suffer? And it's just, that's one of the big key things to this is that, suffering can come in many, many forms. And, there's no AA for shopping. There's, they just recently in the past like couple of days, they have an AA for gambling, but they're still held very separately. Like all these conditions that we have are all held separately, even though it's spiritual bankruptcy is at the core of all of them. The way we see things in the Western world is to keep them all separate. Like, oh, you have depression, anxiety, you go see a therapist. Or you have an alcohol problem, you go see AA. But if you have a drug problem, you go to NA, and then there's all these other A's, and it's ridiculous, the separation. And that happened in, just because all the old geezers back in the day, AA has been around for 100 years now, and NA was created because they didn't want to hear all these damn hippies talk about their drugs and their alcohol meetings without even thinking to themselves that alcohol is a drug. I mean, come on. Like, it's the worst drug. It actually should be a Schedule I narcotic. A Schedule I narcotic is a highly abusable substance without any medical use. What is alcohol? That's alcohol, but it's taxed, so it's okay. But that is the definition of a Schedule I narcotic, which places heroin and cocaine up there too. And they have marijuana in there, which actually does have a medical use, but it's just the separation amongst all these things, and materialism is a big one. And but it's all the same thing. So that's what I realized in my awakenings, that like these are all being treated differently, but it's all the same thing.
Yeah, definitely. So, with your book, what is the biggest takeaway for people that you would like them to have?
I would say hope. I like to consider myself a hope dealer. I would say definitely hope, because when you're going through it, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of hope, but there is, and it's out there. You may feel like the world is against you, and maybe it is, but the universe is for you. So that's all that matters. The universe trumps the world every time. And we go through these things and like grief and stuff, and it's very hard. And I went through that, and there's a process of grief that's just, you're gonna miss people, but embrace it. The old military phrase, embrace the suck, because if you fight it, and the resistance, resistance to pain only turns into suffering. So embrace the pain, so that it whatever you resist is gonna persist. You have to heal it to feel it. So you have to feel it to heal it. And so hope and understanding of why we go through these things, and to not make these things worse by resisting the pain, like shutting it off, just feel it and feel it go through. And yeah, it's hard, and it's part of this life, but there's hope on the way. And the life after this has none of that. I mean, it has none of that, and there's nothing scary about death at all. And I like to think about this. I in the book, I give the best probably argument for simulation theory I've ever heard. And but part of the thing is in a simulation, you know, like if you're in a flight simulator, there's an obvious, there's a reason you're in that. It's to get better at flying in a non-consequential scenario so that you can do better in the real world flying an airplane. Well, here the flying aspect is love. It is the only thing that transcends space and time, and that is what we're supposed to be getting better at. That is the only thing that matters in our day-to-day life. If we're not thinking it in terms of love and at every aspect, it's then start, because that is what this, what we're supposed to hear, what, this is what we're supposed to learn. That is the whole simulation aspect to this nature of reality, is we're supposed to be getting better at that. And the more you're good at that, the more you're spreading love and loving yourself, life gets a lot better. Hope for sure.
Definitely. Justin, thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. If everybody wants to find your book, where can they find it?
Yes, so it's on Amazon. Search for my name, Justin Elshaw, or you can type in the word sorcery with a U. But for some reason, if you type in Sorcery 101, it sends you to a series of books that are apparently about becoming a bitter wizard. So although those sound interesting, they're not mine. So yeah, Justin Elshaw on Amazon, or I have 500 free ebooks to give away. And then I also have some copies here that I can sign and send to people at cost. So I don't have social media, but I do have email, which is sorcerer13 at Gmail, spelled with a U. So Soucerer 13 at Gmail. And then Telegram too, sorcerer13. And those are the ways that you can get it, or just Amazon. It's worth every penny on Amazon too. So, but I'm most interested in getting this information out there and what people think, and go from there. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining me today. And everybody, have a great week ahead. Take care. Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.